Tossing smoke grenades and flashbangs everywhere, Phoenix Force moved low and fast through the shadowy darkness, darting from building to building. Supremely confident that the secret base would never actually see any combat, the Forge soldiers were totally surprised by the attack. Dedicated to a seek-and-destroy mission, the Stony Man Commandos were taking total advantage of the situation and penetrating deep into the heart of the terrorist camp. All they had to do was find the uplink array and blow it apart, or at least smash the operating computers. A simple enough task, but every building they checked that registered a cold blue on the thermal scanners of their IR goggles proved to be a fake. Somebody in Forge expected a night attack, and liquid nitrogen containers were all over the base, the frigid exhaust masking the location of the real supercomputers. And worse, with every tick of the clock, the shock was wearing off the Forge soldiers. Soon there would be organized resistance. The clock was ticking, and the Phoenix Force team had only a few minutes of protective confusion remaining before they were pushed back into the forest. After that, they would be running for their lives, and there would be nobody to stop Calvano from wreaking untold destruction on the helpless world. McCarter touched his throat mic. Firebird to Rock God. Come in, Rock God. Either there was trouble with the Stony Man commsat, or the farm no longer existed.
Anything?
Nothing. Pausing in an intersection, Enciso lifted his IR goggles to read a signpost. He staggered from the hammering blows on his NATO body armor. Then he raised his deadly MP5 SMG. Just then, a trooper carrying a combat shotgun rushed around a corner and paused to gawk at the sight of the strangers. Dressed in camouflage ghillie suits and IR goggles, the Stony Man operatives looked like invaders from Mars. Enciso moved fast, lashing out with a steel-tipped combat boot to kick the man in the groin. Crossing the street, Phoenix Force reached a small brick building. Taking flanking positions, McCarter and Hawkins stood guard while James went to work with a keywire gun on the lock. The offices were empty, dark, and deserted. Briefly checking with an EM scanner, McCarter got no reading of an electromagnetic field from either computers or an uplink. The only thing of interest was a poster on the wall of a pretty Spanish girl in a string bikini skiing down a snowy mountain. McCarter shoved the scanner into a cushioned pocket on the leg of his ghillie suit and moved outside with the rest of the team close behind.
Where next?
High overhead, a Forge soldier was swinging a flamethrower their way, the lance of reddish-yellow fire moving along the street in hellish majesty, the lashing flames splaying along the black asphalt. Thanks, Manning.
Screw that. You've got incoming. Big steel, 3 o'clock and moving fast.
The men of Phoenix Force spun around just as a lumbering Gavin APC turned the corner. The halogen headlights briefly illuminated the team in harsh clarity before they took cover. Then the chattering weapon exploded into pieces thanks to Manning's deadly marksmanship. There was movement inside the Gavin and the armored top hatch flipped open, a Forge soldier grabbing for the 25mm Bushmaster cannon. Phoenix Force expected that move. Hawkins flipped a grenade into the air.
This is taking too bleeding long. Everybody spread out and find the base security bunker. They'll know the location of the uplink array.
Without comment, the Stony Man operatives took off in different directions, swiftly disappearing into the murky shadows. A rumpled man in a bathrobe strode into the room with a monstrous .50 Desert Eagle pistol in his fist. Looking up from their consoles at Calvano, the Forge soldiers said nothing and went straight back to work. Wearing helmets and body armor, armed guards stood nervously in the corners, twisting their hands on the FN-2000 assault rifles, clearly wishing they were outside and mixing in the fight. Grenades festooned the web harnesses on their chests, and one man carried an XM-214 minigun.
OD, what is happening on my base?
We're being attacked by unknown forces, sir. Mortar fire from the hillside along with a sniper.
And? Speak, man, or I'll have your balls for breakfast.
There have been some reports of commandos actually inside the base, but nothing confirmed yet.
Reports from where?
All over, sir. The old offices, the storage shed 5, the abandoned barracks, the other cold spots.
Calvano walked along the banks of video monitors. Most of the screens in the woods surrounding the base showed nothing of interest. A moonlit forest glen, a babbling brook, the main access road. But an entire row of screens was blank, the feeds terminated, and several more displayed the burning bridge collapsed into the Ontonio River and the ruin of the front gate. Dead bodies lay everywhere, Blast craters dotted the landscape, and dozens of soldiers ran about firing their weapons. One corporal moved through the cars in the parking lot, smashing windows with the butt of his gun and turning on the headlights. The rows of beams were starting to brighten the smoky gloom, showing more dead soldiers and the same burning buildings.
The cold spots. They're trying to find the supercomputer running the uplink. All right, recall everybody outside the base. I want a wall of men surrounding the base.
Something flashed across the video screen, showing the parking lot and several cars violently exploding, flipping into the air and turning over to crash on their crumpled hoods from the sheer force of the detonation. All of the headlights winked out, and darkness returned with a vengeance.
That was a law rocket. Odie, are there any people still on the roofs?
No, sir. All dead.
Oh, how is that possible?
My best guess is a Barrett rifle, sir. Every shot kills one or two of our troops. Even the men wearing heavy armor.
What about the Gavins?
I have six blocking the holes in the fence. Three are being held in reserve, and one is not responding.
That means it's been destroyed.
You there, private. Zoom in on that screen.
That's a smoke grenade, and not the model we carry.
Puzzled, the general stared at the sight of the buckled door to the garage coming free from the hinges and falling to the ground.
Now, why in the world would this sniper smash down the door to the garage? Unless... Get the Gavins out of there! Now! Right now!
Another law rocket streaked across the base and went straight through the man-size opening. The blast filled the garage. Then a moment later, the entire building erupted, the windows exploding and the roof rising on a staggering fireball as the emergency stores of gasoline and munitions simultaneously ignited.
So much for the reserve, Gavins. Odie, get the Ashanti helicopters into the air! Bomb those hills until the forest is leveled! But kill that sniper!
Already on the way, sir.
Glancing at the side monitor, Calvano smiled at the sight of four black ghosts rising into the air from the small helipad in the center of the firebase. Recently purchased on the black market by Snake Eater, the sleek Italian gunships were armored killers, carrying more firepower than a dozen Gavins. Then he sharply frowned as one of the helicopters turned on its running lights as required by standard safety precautions.
Combat mode, idiot! Odie, have that moron go black at once!
But before the soldier could act, the distant Barrett spoke once more. The windshield shattered and the helicopter wobbled, then listed sideways and touched rotors with a second. In a shattering microsecond, the 16 spinning turbo blades of the two gunships were shredded into shrapnel. The deadly halo of fiberglass and steel radiated outward to hammer the other two gunships. Both exploded, and in ragged order, the four crippled helicopters dropped 100 feet to crash on the concrete helipad. Illuminated from below by the scattered fire, the roiling cloud made it look as if the military compound had been nuked.
Mother of God.
Odie, warm up the Pegasus.
The base was lost. It was time to leave. They would continue the great project from their main fire base in the Andes.
And sound the retreat. Everybody is to gather at the parade ground in 5 minutes or be left behind.
But sir, the bridge is gone. Our people across the river can't get back here in that short a time.
Yes, I know.
Calvano pulled a chain from around his neck. A small hexagonal key was attached. The OD stood.
Sir, please, there must be another way.
No, there is not.
Calvano went to the main console and inserted the key into a hole. The panel slid aside, exposing a sheet of glass with a keypad underneath. The general typed a long code sequence into the keypad, then pressed his thumb to a sensor plate. Immediately, every video screen in the security office was filled with bright light. Tons of high explosives, situated under the fake uplink dish hidden inside the copse of pine trees, detonated.
Our brothers have made the ultimate sacrifice. Now we must do our part. We've lost a battle, but not the war. Death to America! God bless Argentina!
They practiced the emergency drill only a couple of times. Nobody ever thought it would come to pass. But this was a night of impossible events. As the OD closed the door behind the last soldier, a strong smell of burning plastic tickled his nose, and several of the consoles began to glow a dull red from deep inside. The magnesium charges had already destroyed the feeder circuits to the controls, rendering them inert, removing any possibility of an enemy tech trying to deactivate the automatic self-destruct. 30 seconds after that, the thermite charges inside the walls would cut loose, and the entire brick building would be swiftly removed from existence. Twisting the key in the lock to jam the door solidly in place, the Forge officer turned and raced along the access tunnel to rejoin the General and the rest of his brothers. Firebase Alpha was lost, and dozens of Forge soldiers were dead, but nothing could stop the great project. When the coming nuclear war was finally over, Forge would emerge from their underground bunkers to seize control of Argentina and lead the way to a cleaner, saner world peace and prosperity. But at the moment, there was other work to do. Bursting out of the tunnel, the OD paused, then grabbed an assault rifle from a dead Forge soldier lying sprawled on the sidewalk. He headed into the swirling smoke for the parade ground. Everything depended on the General now, but time was short.
Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
Carl Lyons drove into downtown Sioux Falls. The traffic was sparse early in the morning. A few newspaper trucks dropped off stacks to convenience stores. A couple of pickup trucks were piled high with boxes of new computers. There was a yawning man on a motorcycle and a handful of assorted civilian cars. The drivers talked on cell phones and drank from plastic coffee mugs. Thankfully, there were no police in sight. As it turned out, Trinity brought along three Hummers full of supplies, most of which had been given to the other Mercs. After disarming a couple of traps, Lyons took the best of the three Hummers and reclaimed his fellow teammates on the highway. They headed north on Route 29, keeping a careful watch on the skies. When police state helicopters appeared in the distance, Lyons drove the Hummer off the interstate and took refuge under the trees of an apple orchard, until the coast was clear once more. Their cell phones began working along the way, which seemed to indicate only the East Coast commsats had been moved. Briefly, Blancanellis tried a number dedicated to a restricted government landline and found it jammed solid with calls. But that was expected. Crossing over the border into South Dakota, Lyons stopped to refuel the Hummer, while Blancanellis got them food from the restaurant. Schwartz did things to the pay telephone. Getting back on the highway, Lyons drove swiftly into Sioux City and started searching for a construction site. It took a while, but the team finally found a small strip mall under construction near a new Native American casino. After parking the Hummer, Lyons went to the phone to attach another electronic device to the mouthpiece. A lounging street gang eyed the men in the new car with interest and began to saunter over until Blancanellis and Schwartz displayed the M16 assault rifles through the car windows. "Move along." Without missing a beat, the street gang angled away and left the area. At the payphone, the ABLE team leader finished attaching the device to the receiver. Schwartz swore the jumper would make anybody trying to trace the call believe it was coming from the sister unit near the border.
"Any way to test this gadget?"
"Nope."
"Then here we go."
"Homeland Security, how may I direct your call?"
Code 19. "Special Agent Fielding here."
"Ident code?"
Lyons grinned. Fielding was a member of the 30, the elite group of Secret Service agents assigned to personally guard the President of the United States.
"Is the Traveler in danger?"
Traveler was one of the many code names for the President.
Yes! Musket! Oh, Christ, my guts!
"Is Traveler hurt or compromised?"
"Traveler is... my guts are on fire. They tell us how bad it'll be at Q, but mother of God!"
"You're shot in the stomach? Son of a... Location! Special Agent Fielding, report your location!"
"Border of South Dakota, 76 Roland Drive."
Glancing about to see if the pistol shots drew any unwanted attention, the man saw Blancanellis' choice of locations was spot on. Construction sites were always full of noise, and after only a few days, the neighbors stopped paying attention to anything they heard. Walking in place, Lyons then lifted the receiver again and gently hung up. Lyons got back behind the wheel of the Hummer.
"Done. A wounded member of the 30 in distress will have Homeland send everybody they can scrape together to that rest stop and start a house-by-house search.
One of them is a known crack house that will not want to be searched, so I wish them luck there."
"My money's on Homeland."
"Agreed. But we'll only have a maximum window of 5 hours before they realize it's a trick, possibly only 4.
after which they'll call the National Guard and fill the city with troops expecting a terrorist attack. So we'd better be long gone by then. In case of trouble with the local police, the M203 grenade launcher was loaded with a stun bag, but the ammo clip was full of 5.56mm heat rounds, high-explosive armor-piercing tracers, a gift from the dearly departed Trinity.
This never would have worked if the East Coast satellites weren't down.
Schwartz tucked his assault rifle away and pulled out his U.S. Army laptop.
In this sort of situation, the first thing Homeland will do is try to contact the White House, but with the cell phones down and the landlines jammed...
They'll go apeshit. Got the correct address of where we're going?
Think so. Take the next left, and then go straight for a mile.
Nodding acknowledgement, Lyons followed the directions to outside the city limits. Even for a president in trouble, there would still be a skeleton staff staying at the HSA office. The place was never totally empty. There were far too many important files to keep from falling into criminal hands. On the other hand, the secret Homeland Armory should be totally deserted. In short order, Able Team reached a storage facility near the beginning of the Rocky Desert. At the fuel station across the street, Schwartz watched the EM scanner and Lyons swept the area with enhanced field glasses. There was a weedy lot alongside the storage facility, home to a Pontiac Firebird slowly disintegrating back into the soil. The other side was an abandoned drive-in theater, the silver screen peeling away from the metal framework behind. Checking his pocket EM scanner, Lyons found no hotspots in the storage facility. So unless there were people inside wearing NSA spacesuits or drenched in ice, the armory was deserted. Anything?
Everything's clear as far as I can tell. No chatter on the radio bands. Passive radar's clear, no unusual EM spikes. The place looks clean. Except that the fence around this storage facility isn't galvanized steel, but military-grade titanium. The same stuff the farm uses to halt incoming missiles.
Then let's move.
Driving casually across the road, Lyons read a closed notice posted in the window of the small office. Ignoring that, the Stony Man operative carefully maneuvered the entry keypad alongside the rear passenger window. Schwartz slid a data card into the slot. The plastic rectangle was covered with exposed circuitry. Thin wires attached to the end trailed back to his laptop. The screen illuminated with binary codes, and Schwartz hit a few keys in rapid sequence. The heavy gate opened, and Lyons drove inside the complex.
Easy as pie.
Try making a pie sometime.
Blanc and Ellis watched the passing rows of locked doors. There were no alleys or back doors or any other conceivable hiding places, just a flat apron of black asphalt surrounding the neat rows of painted steel sheds. If the team was attacked out here, it would be a slaughter. They were already trespassing on a secret government installation. Any guards would shoot first and never ask questions.
Which storage unit is it?
B-13.
And there it is.
Heading in that direction, Lyons noted a cluster of propane tanks at the end of the row of sheds. They seemed strangely out of place, and he made a mental note of their location. They parked in front of B-10. Able Team slipped on hard hats and picked up toolboxes. The three men were dressed in dull gray coveralls and bright orange safety vests marked with the letters DPW, Department of Public Works. Stretching as if they'd been driving for a long time, the Stony Man operatives warily surveyed the area. Everything seemed peaceful and quiet. Going to B-12, Lyons pulled out a key wire gun and tricked open the padlock. As he swung open the door, there was a seamless sheet of plastic blocking the entrance.
Damn!
He planned to open a joining unit and listen for any movements inside B-13. Now, he had a feeling there were no individual storage units, just one huge unit 200 feet long. That wasn't an armory, it was a supply depot. Lyons went to B-13 and tricked the padlock. As the door swung away, a ferruled slab of steel was revealed, resembling a bank vault door. There was a keypad and a flat screen roughly in the shape of a hand, a state-of-the-art palm lock. Stepping aside, Lyons and Blancanales blocked any casual view as Schwartz went to work on the door with his U.S. Army laptop and some electronic probes. Schwartz pushed against the metal door and it smoothly swung aside on silent hinges, revealing only inky blackness. Pulling small flashlights from their vests, Able Team probed the darkness with their white beams, revealing rows of gleaming assault rifles and huge pallets stacked with trays of grenades.
Jackpot!
Schwartz swept an EM scanner across the area. There were some background readings for the power lines, but nothing else. There were no working video cameras, proximity sensors, or live microphones in the lab. With his Colt Python in one hand and a flashlight in the other, Lyons took point and eased inside the disguised building.
Okay, you know what we need. Let's find a hand truck and start loading the Hummer.
We have 4 to 5 minutes and counting.
Sahara Desert, Middle East.
A slim man dressed in a three-piece suit strode down a long corridor, passing rows of doors marked with project names. There were no departments in Unity, only goals. Whatever resources were needed for a mission were assembled and unleashed. But the destruction of a single group in no way hurt or hindered the other teams. Each was totally autonomous once activated. This afforded terrorist organizations safety from the great Satan, British, and the hated Israelis, for decades. It was the secret to their success. Not cells of communication like the communists, but cells of power. Independent teams with no knowledge of the others. Only the Supreme Council knew everything, and it could never be reached this far below the ground in the middle of nowhere. Proceeding to the end of a long hallway, the man passed in front of a titanic pair of bronze doors flanked by a set of concrete pillboxes, the sort of fortifications that were so popular during World War II. Inside the stout redoubts were teams of men who operated the 40mm Vulcan electric miniguns and twin 50-caliber machine guns. The weapons were chosen for their ability to stop the charge of most armored personnel carriers or even a light tank. However, it would be impossible for those war machines to make it down the slim elevator shaft. Any team of invaders fast enough to reach the command center of Unity wasn't armored enough to withstand the heavy weaponry of the pillboxes. Standing in front of the doors, the man waited, knowing that sensors and probes were sweeping over his body for weapons, recording devices, or anything else on the long list of contraband material. This was the nerve center of Unity, and no chances would be taken with the safety of the men behind the big doors. If they fell, so did the entire terrorist network across the globe. The leader of Unity was at the end of a long table.
Well?
A score of other men and two women sat in chairs along the table, the smooth, polished surface covered with papers and documents, small computer monitors built flush into the surface for each member of the Supreme Council.
Hamas failed. Our spy in Forge has informed me that something went wrong in Turkey, and the Hamas are all dead from radiation.
Then they didn't steal the bombs. We were idiots to trust such an important task to those bombing buffoons.
No, my Syrian brother. Hamas is loyal to the cause, and they did their best. Failure comes to us all in spite of the most detailed planning and expert people.
What are your new instructions?
In spite of this new development, I think that we should proceed with the planned attack on America.
The representative of Libya nearly stood.
Are you insane? We only have this one nuke, and you have no idea what our people had to do to get it.
On the contrary, I know in precise detail. After all, it was my plan that obtained us the nuclear device from the NATO storage facility in Turkey. Plus, it was my Russian and Chinese scientists who modified it from simple atomic explosive into a powerful hydrogen bomb, 1,000 times stronger.
But Hamas failed.
Irrelevant. It would have been best for America to blame Hamas for the coming attack, but no matter. My people assure me there is no way the strike can be traced back to our launch facility here.
But what if—
Enough! The time is right, and we finally have the weapons needed to strike hard and deep into America. Not a mere show of force, but hard enough to wound them to the very core.
Do we? To the best of my knowledge, the kill range of a Class 9 warhead is 4 city blocks. Maybe 6 under precisely right circumstances.
6 blocks?
Going to a map on the wall, the newcomer took a slim tube from the vest pocket of his suit and played the red dot of the laser pointer across the east coast of the United States.
This is not some pitiful tactical nuclear weapon. This is now a thermonuclear device, boosted by a tritium injector. The fireball alone will be 10 blocks wide, and the blast will spread over 100 miles.
That large? Praise be to Allah!
No known god had anything to do with their plans of destruction, but the leader of Unity nodded in reply. War was a matter of politics, nothing else.
With a kill zone this large, we can easily avoid the impressive air defenses of Washington and have the missile strike, say, Richmond, or even the farmland outside of Lynchburg. There's nothing there of any importance to protect, so the defenses will be minimal.
But even if anti-missiles were to detonate our stolen ICBM high in the air, the shockwave would still kill 1 million Americans, maybe twice that number. And if it hits the ground, the blast wave would destroy every prime target on our kill list. CIA headquarters, FBI headquarters, Dulles Airport, the Pentagon, Congress, the Senate, the White House. Everything from the Atlantic Ocean to Kentucky would be obliterated, reduced to radioactive debris.
The wall map rose into the ceiling to reveal a blackboard covered with complex mathematical equations. All of the men frowned in concentration, struggling to process the staggering figures. Only the leader of Unity leaned back in his chair, slowly smiling in pleasure. The math was far beyond his simple education, but he knew people. If the young man had the figures ready for their inspection, then they had to be true.
Yes, I see. Most impressive.
Thank you, sir.
With this new information, I withdraw my objection. Let us proceed immediately.
But make haste. The Americans are not fools. We should fire the missile the instant it is ready. Give them no time to find us and to stop it from being launched.
And what should be the target, sir?
The newcomer stood straight. When America fell, his would be the name attached to the great victory. Who would remember the old men and women who laid the plans? Only the men who did the work would be praised by the people, hailed as heroes from the Arabian Sea to the Atlantic Ocean.
Where indeed?
The leader of Unity looked over the map of the area. West Virginia, Maryland, Delaware, Washington, Virginia. This was the very heart of their hated enemy. A blow anywhere would do incalculable destruction. Did the exact target really matter? Not in the least. The youngster was merely trying to curry favor with the council. Fair enough. He would accept the meaningless compliment with dignity and grace, even though privately marking the ambitious fool for later execution.
There. Right there, in the middle of a forest where there are no missiles or interceptors to hinder us in any way whatsoever. We shall strike there and let the atomic blast roll across the farmlands of Virginia to destroy Washington forever.
The young man pulled out a PDA and marked the kill zone for their thermonuclear ICBM, an unknown forest preserve called the Shenandoah National Park.
Firebase Alpha, Argentina.
Moving stealthily through the smoky darkness, McCarter finally located the parade ground and scowled at the sight of the monstrous helicopter. The huge craft was a CH-53 Super Stallion, just about the strongest and largest cargo helicopter in the world. The craft was 100 feet long, with three colossal turbo engines, and could lift over 50 soldiers plus a ton of supplies. This was no patch job or good old leftover from another war, but pure state-of-the-art and top of the line. Near the prow was the picture of a winged horse painted on the metal with the name Pegasus underneath in a flowing script. A couple of forged soldiers were still dragging the canvas sheeting away, and the pilot was in the cockpit flipping switches in a pre-flight check. The general had to be trying to escape, which meant the bastard was coming right into the gun sights of McCarter. He touched his throat mic.
Red alert. There's a Super Stallion on a parade ground getting ready to leave. Cargo must be Calvano.
Can't see it. There's too much flame and smoke.
We're on the way. Stay loose and... Damn!
Somebody at Forge detected the radio transmissions and was jamming the airwaves. A dozen Gavins appeared around the mess hall, and McCarter quickly took over. The three sets of propellers of the Pegasus were beginning to slowly rotate when the convoy of armored personnel carriers rolled to a halt alongside. General Calvano climbed out of a vehicle closely surrounded by armed troops. Out of grenades, McCarter could only track the mob of people in the sights of his MP5, hoping for a shot at the leader of Forge. But the bodyguards knew their business, and the general reached the Pegasus safely. Still trying to maneuver into position to get a clear shot at the general, or to find some way to cripple the huge helicopter, McCarter was forced to take cover again as dozens of armed Forge soldiers began to arrive at the parade ground. In orderly procession, the soldiers climbed inside the colossal helicopter. Desperately, McCarter checked again for even a single grenade, but he was completely out. The soft lead 9mm rounds in the MP5 would do nothing against the armored hull of a Super Stallion. The last of the troops arrived. Then the hatch was closed and the door shut. They were getting ready to leave.
Come on, guys, where are you?
McCarter drew the pneumatic pistol from his shoulder holster, then aimed. The first dart veered off into the night, deflected by the mounting turbulence of the three sets of spinning blades. Finally, one of the barbed darts lodged into the soft rubber of a landing wheel. Pegasus lifted gently off the grass. A moment later, Hawkins and Zizo and James appeared out of the darkness.
Any grenades?
None.
Check a Gavin. See if you can turn one of the 25mm Bushmasters on that flying office building.
Nodding, the men melted into the darkness, but just then the Pegasus lifted high into the nighttime sky above the burning firebase and angled off toward the west. Soon, the top hatches of three of the Gavins flipped up, and members of Phoenix Force rose into view to swivel the Bushmasters at the departing airship. The phosphorescent tracers among the 25mm HE shells dotted the sky, only to strive for the Super Stallion as the huge helicopter continued to rapidly climb higher. Moving behind a flagpole for protection, McCarter rode out the wave of hot lead. Safe again, he then stepped out with his SMG. The Stony Man operatives expertly moved their weapons in tight circles, but the weapons were impossible to accurately aim at the fleeing helicopter. The side of the Pegasus visibly dented from the distant Barrett. Instantly, defensive smoke poured from a series of vents around the Super Stallion, and the three sets of turboprops spun to full power as the chopper angled away from the potential danger, slipping into the clouds of roiling smoke to disappear from sight. They had missed killing the general by only a few seconds. Glancing around the fiery desecration of the military base, McCarter pulled a small device from a cushioned pocket of his ghillie suit. The tiny screen became illuminated with a map of Argentina. Four blinking dots showed on the screen, one of them moving steadily to the west. Touching the controls, he blanked the darts that had missed the Super Stallion, and now there was only one winking icon on the screen. Gotcha!
North Dakota.
Crawling over the blistering hot rocks, Carl Lyons crested the escarpment and looked down on the five men. The Forge soldiers were all carrying LAW rockets with FN-2000 assault rifles slung across their backs. Staying low behind a row of loose boulders, the gaps filled with sagebrushes, the soldiers sat on folding canvas stools, drinking from canteens, while keeping a sharp watch on the nearby roadway. 100 feet away, Route 29 cut through the bleak landscape like a black river. The highway curved near the boulders, forcing any traffic to slow down considerably, making the location a perfect spot for an ambush. Lyons eased the safety off his Neostad shotgun. A recent acquisition from the HSA Armory, the left tubular magazine of the deadly weapon held four stun bags of the newest variety. More than just wads of cloth with soft, jelly beads inside, these also contained breakable capsules that released an anesthesia compound that could put down a charging rhino. And just in case those didn't handle the problem, the other magazine held four 12-gauge cartridges of stainless steel flechettes. They didn't knock a man unconscious. They cut the poor bastard in two. Knowing they were heading into a trap, Able Team wisely turned off Route 29 a good hour before reaching the North Dakota border and swung far out into the rocky Badlands to circle around to try to approach the Forge soldiers from behind. It took a while, but they found the ambush. Retreating to a safe distance, the men discussed the matter and quickly headed in different directions. Lyons stayed with the soldiers, while Schwartz and Blancanales drove far into the desert on rented motorcycles. They got the big black BMW bikes in Huron, outside of Sioux Falls. Using a transmission instead of a chain, the motorcycles were extremely quiet, and it took less than an hour to coat the machines with industrial glue, then liberally apply a thick layer of sand. Now the black bikes were a dull, rusty color. Even the windshields were gone to make sure there was nothing shiny to accidentally reveal the presence of the silenced machines. Lyons touched his earphone as he checked his wristwatch. The others were finally in place, and the Forge soldiers should be reporting to their headquarters any minute now. Regular as clockwork, the men stationed below Lyons used their Kenwood hand radios to report to somebody. The same as back in Texas. The radio signals were heavily encoded, but knowing the frequency used by the enemy gave the Stony Man commandos all they needed. With Schwartz and Blancanales about 100 miles away to the west and east, when the Forge soldiers sent off their hourly status report, the three men could use loop antennae to triangulate on the broadcast. And when their hidden base responded, they could have it located within a few yards.
Unless they're smart enough to change frequencies every time they talk.
Lyons adjusted the controls on a directional radio with a loop antenna on top. The portable radios of Stony Man changed frequencies automatically, just like the transponders used by the Navy SEALs and Delta Force. It all depended upon how savvy their commander was with counterintelligence technology. Covering a yawn, a Forge soldier laid aside his law and lifted a radio. Swinging up a monocular, Lyons dialed for maximum enhancement and got a crystal-clear view of the Kenwood as the man tapped in the code. Punching the code into another Kenwood, stolen from the HSA armory, Lyons could clearly hear the lieutenant's report.
Nothing has happened yet.
Roger that. Stay alert.
Got him, Lyons. Their base is at Black Rock Mesa in McHenry County, about 50 miles deep in the heart of the Badlands.
Tucking away the loop antenna, Lyons turned his head in that direction. The barren landscape was rough and rugged, a vast rocky vista of irregular stone.
Any back doors?
He lifted the monocular and thumbed the solar filter. The view dimmed slightly as the glare of the sun was removed and he had a clear view to the horizon. Tabletop Mesa and craggy mountain peaks stood like castles on the flat ground. Driving their Hummer across that in broad daylight would be suicide, and there was no time to wait for night. The internet was buzzing with news from around the globe of ever-increasing military conflicts. The world was poised for war, and every minute counted. If they took too long seizing control of the uplink array, or failed in their mission, the civilization death toll could be astronomical.
Checking. Okay, according to this topographical map I bought at the mountaineering store, there should be a rill we can drive behind to hide our approach until about a mile away from Black Rock. Then we only have to cross about a few yards of open space before we can duck behind another mesa. That will let us get within 200 feet.
If the approach is so good, Ford should have the area heavily mined. No, forget that. This state is full of hikers and tourists. If a troop of Boy Scouts got blown apart, the National Guard would seal off the entire territory and do a rock-by-rock search for any more explosives.
They could use remote control landmines, like the farm. Fiber optic cables wouldn't leak any magnetic field for a park ranger to detect, but our EM scanners will let us know if the cameras are live or not.
Good enough. But we still have to cross 200 feet of open space in broad daylight. Can we do that in under 90 seconds?
Not without dropping a lot of equipment.
Or we can give them something to look at.
Lyons pulled a knife and started to hack at the loose soil.
Leaving them a little gift, Lyons?
Biggest one I have, actually.
When the hole was large enough, he laid an M2 satchel charge inside and loosely covered it with dirt, leaving only an inch of the ebony antenna sticking up from the reddish ground.
Make sure it isn't going to start a rock slide and take out a lot of civvies on the road.
No danger of that. I just hate to leave them alive.
Unfortunately, killing them now would only alert the people inside the mesa when they failed to make their hourly report.
Yeah, I know. So let them keep waiting for Trinity.
You know there's still going to be some kind of surveillance along the perimeter of the mesa, even if it is only more armed guards.
Too bad for them.
Lyons checked the arming circuit on the military explosive.
All set here. We rendezvous at the northern rail in an hour.
A Forge technician looked up from his console in command and control.
Sir!
Yes, what is it?
Erica Sabot was reading the result of the latest GPS attacks. The computerized clipboard in her hand was equipped with a Bluetooth and relayed a steady stream of data from the internet. On the master console, a monitor scrolled with constant reports from Snake Eater, and while not officially part of her job, Sabot considered it only good sense to make sure the foreigner was telling them the truth about the assorted strikes. So far, so good.
I caught a radio transmission a few seconds ago. It was localized, scrambled, and not from one of our sentry outposts.
Are you sure?
Absolutely.
I don't like this. Better inform Professor Reinhold, and double the guards at all entrances.
At once, ma'am.
Also, send out a reconnaissance party to check the perimeter, especially the rill to the north.
Should the troops take prisoners if they find anybody?
No. The time for secrecy is nearly over. Better have the guards kill anybody they find.
Yes, ma'am.
And activate the landmines.
Andes Mountains, Western Argentina.
A gentle snow fell on the windshield of the Hummer. The halogen headlights stabbed into the dancing flakes and soon vanished. Visibility was only a dozen yards. McCarter kept a sharp watch on the edge of the steep road only a few feet away. Far below was a deep crevice, the bottom masked in lazy fog. There was nothing ahead of them or behind, only the snow and mist. It was as if they were driving through a dream. Escaping from Fort Perón had proved to be simplicity itself for the Stony Man operatives. Reaching the forest in their liberated Gavin APCs, Phoenix Force kept on going, plowing deep into the morass of trees, leaving the legacy of General Calvino far behind. One of the APCs passed by the empty auto mortar set by Manning. There were several dead Forge soldiers lying around the weapon, but none of them managed to breach the protective ring of Claymore mines encircling the mortar. Cresting the ridge of the woody hillock, the team rendezvoused with Manning in a small clearing. The man rose from the bushes like a pagan god. Exchanging grins of relief that everybody was alive, Manning climbed into the APC driven by McCarter, and the three vehicles left the decimated battle zone to reclaim their stash of supplies in the old mine. That was all of the food and ammunition the team had remaining, and the Stony Man Commandos knew they'd need every pound for when they tangled with Forge again. After checking over the fuel and munitions, McCarter decided they would use the Hummer instead of the APCs. The Gavins could carry more, but an armored personnel carrier was painfully noticeable in civilian traffic. There was no way they could remain covert driving a Gavin on a public road. Besides, the Hummer got better gas mileage, and there was no telling yet where the Pegasus was flying. The blip on the tracking device was still in motion, proceeding ever deeper into the rugged expanse of the Argentine Andes Mountains. After bandaging some minor wounds, the team had shifted everything usable into the Hummer and took off immediately, heading back to the Continental Highway rather than smashing their way through the dense forest. They'd make better time on the paved road. Driving the Hummer until the needle was almost on empty, McCarter refueled at a roadside gas station, while Hawkins bought as many cans of fuel as they could without being conspicuous. James and Manning depleted a roadside restaurant of whatever consumables were available, and Enciso emptied a small hunting store of as much spare ammunition for their military weapons as possible. There was a cornucopia of 9mm bullets and 12-gauge shotgun shells, but only a single box of .357 Magnum rounds for Manning's Desert Eagle, the same for Enciso's .38 Walther PPK, and nothing for the 5.56mm FN-2000 assault rifles. Wisely, he didn't even ask the happy clerk about ammunition for the Barrett sniper rifle. After delivering the supplies to the Hummer, Hawkins and James went to a corner market to purchase several bottles of ammonia and a large plastic bucket, just in case. Taking turns behind the wheel, the men of Phoenix Force drove through the remaining darkness and all the next day, doggedly keeping track of the Pegasus and Calvano. The blip finally stopped in a hotly contested section of the mountain range, the area claimed by Argentina, Chile, and the communist guerrillas. That was good news. There would be few civilians around and plenty of combat room for the coming battle. The general managed to escape from Phoenix Force once, but it would never happen again. A long day slowly faded into night, and the farther Phoenix Force drove into the mountains, the steeper and more narrow the roads became. The air got colder by the mile. Then the windows became frosty, and then the first snowflakes appeared. A sign near a town warned this was the last chance for gas in 100 kilometers, so McCarter turned off the highway. The team decided to stop and have a fast meal, probably their last before the assault on the Forge firebase. At their stop, Phoenix Force judiciously hit the local shops for additional supplies. The snow was an unexpected complication. Woolen long john underwear, boots, and gloves were available, but the only parkas for sale were a bright orange color to make lost people easier to find in the mountains. However, an hour at the local laundry with a couple of bottles of bleach rendered the parkas a muddy flesh tone, close enough to white to serve as winter camouflage. Next came skis and poles, then snowmobiles and snowshoes, plus a lot of beer, the last item added to make them seem like a group of gringo tourists just there for a drunken weekend. The snowmobiles had powerful motors that could propel the sleek machines at well over 60 miles per hour, but they made more noise than a wood chipper. On the other hand, the auxiliary electric motors were nearly dead silent, but only had a top speed of 25 miles per hour. Stealth or speed, it was good to have a choice. McCarter had Hawkins take an exit shortly after their stop to follow a long, winding road into the foothills. The ice-covered roads were slippery, but the Hummer traversed them with little problem, the rough military tires digging in hard. Snow fell soft and silent from the white sky, and it seemed to McCarter that a blizzard was coming. That was both good and bad. The weather would help hide them from the Forge troops, but would also make it tough to find their hidden base. McCarter only hoped the Forge didn't have any more guard dogs. The bloody parkas reeked of bleach so badly the team members could have been tracked through a sewage plant. Ignoring the beef jerky and MRE packs, they extracted the handful of U.S. Army self-heat meals they had brought along. Popping open the tops on the lumpy bags, they poured in some water from their canteens and tightly closed the tops again. As the crystals inside the envelopes reacted to the water, the packages became warm, and soon wisps of steam rose from the tiny vents. Eagerly, Phoenix Force tore into the bags for their first hot meal in days.
Ah, best thing ever invented. Ah, yum.
Amen to that, brother.
McCarter jerked around with a Browning high-power pistol in his hand. A moment later, a llama walked out of the snowy bushes and casually strolled past the Hummer as if it weren't there.
Wonder what those taste like.
Rather a lot like emu.
Emu?
Close enough, anyway.
God, you're a weird bastard.
After taking the brief break to eat, the team drove the Hummer into the bushes. They cut down branches to cover the vehicle, then slid the snowmobiles off the trailer. Checking over their weapons one last time, Phoenix Force started across a snowy field and darted into the misty expanse of trees. Constantly checking a compass, McCarter led the other men through the forest and up a gentle foothill. Long, slow, cold miles passed when suddenly Hawkins jerked his head upward.
Plane!
And the team darted for cover.
Might be a mail plane or a delivery service ferrying supplies to mountain resorts. We do that all the time in Canada.
Enciso worked the arming bolt on an FN-2000 assault rifle. The longer barrel gave the weapon much greater range than the MP5 and would count for a lot when fighting with an aircraft.
Or it might be a reconnaissance plane for Forge.
McCarter pulled out a monocular to check the clouds. IR showed nothing, so he switched to UV. Now he got a blurry image.
Okay. She appears to be a single-engine Cessna, but it's impossible to tell for sure. However, it's armed with a bleeding rocket pod on each wing.
Or the federal police, Argentine army, Chileans, or the goddamn commie guerrillas. Good thing we reached the trees. Those anti-tank rockets would have blown us into the next world.
And then some.
Bases to the west. It must be doing a perimeter sweep. Okay, we go silent from this point. We better get far away from here before it comes back for a second pass.
Time to reload. Stony Man is continued on the next CD.